By now, I moved like a sleepwalker. I sometimes closed my eyes, and it was like running while asleep. Now and then, someone kicked me violently from behind, and I would wake up. The man in back of me was screaming, "Run faster! If you don't want to move, let us pass you!" But all I had to do was close my eyes, to see a whole world pass before me, to dream of another life. The road was endless. To allow oneself to be carried by the mob, to be swept away by blind fate. When the SS were tired, they were replaced, but no one replaced us. Chilled to the bone, our throats parched, famished, out of breath, we pressed on. We were the masters of nature, the masters of the world. We had transcended everything, death, fatigue, our natural needs. We were stronger than cold and hunger, stronger than the guns and the desire to die, doomed and rootless, nothing but numbers. We were the only men on earth. At last, the morning star appeared in the gray sky. A hesitant light began to hover on the horizon. We were exhausted. We had lost all strength, all illusion. The commandant announced that we had already covered 20 kilometers since we left. Long since, we had exceeded the limits of fatigue. Our legs moved mechanically, in spite of us, without us. We came to an abandoned village. Not a living soul. Not a single bark. Houses with gaping windows. A few people slipped out of the ranks, hoping to hide in some abandoned building. One more hour of marching and, at last, the order to halt. As one man, we let ourselves sink into the snow. My father shook me.
"Not here. Get up. A little farther down. There is a shed over there. Come."
I had neither the desire nor the resolve to get up. Yet I obeyed. It was not really a shed, but a brick factory whose roof had fallen in. Its window panes were shattered, its walls covered in soot. It was not easy to get inside. Hundreds of prisoners jostled one another at the door. We finally succeeded in entering. Inside, too, the snow was thick. I let myself slide to the ground. Only now did I feel the full extent of my weakness. The snow seemed to me like a very soft, very warm carpet. I fell asleep. I don't know how long I slept, a few minutes or 1 hour. When I woke up, a frigid hand was tapping my cheeks. I tried to open my eyes. It was my father. How he had aged since last night! His body was completely twisted, shriveled up into himself. His eyes were glazed over, his lips parched, decayed. Everything about him expressed total exhaustion. His voice was damp from tears and snow.
"Don't let yourself be overcome by sleep, Eliezer. It's dangerous to fall asleep in snow. One falls asleep forever. Come, my son, come, get up."
"Get up? How could I? How was I to leave this warm blanket?" I was hearing my father's words, but their meaning escaped me, as if he had asked me to carry the entire shed on my arms.
"Come, my son, come."
I got up with clenched teeth. Holding on to me with one arm, he led me outside. It was not easy. It was as difficult to go out as to come in. Beneath our feet there lay men, crushed, trampled underfoot, dying. Nobody paid attention to them. We were outside. The icy wind whipped my face. I was constantly biting my lips so that they wouldn't freeze. All around me, what appeared to be a dance of death. My head was reeling. I was walking through a cemetery. Among the stiffened corpses, there were logs of wood. Not a sound of distress, not a plaintive cry. Nothing but mass agony and silence. Nobody asked anyone for help. One died because one had to. No point in making trouble. I saw myself in every stiffened corpse. Soon I wouldn't even be seeing them anymore. I would be one of them. A matter of hours.
"Come, Father, let's go back to the shed."
He didn't answer. He was not even looking at the dead.
Come, Father, it's better there. You'll be able to lie down. We'll take turns. I'll watch over you, and you'll watch over me. We won't let each other fall asleep. We'll look after each other.
He accepted. After trampling over many bodies and corpses, we succeeded in getting inside. We let ourselves fall to the ground.
Don't worry, son. Go to sleep. I'll watch over you.
You first, Father. Sleep.
He refused. I stretched out and tried to sleep, to doze a little, but in vain. God knows what I would have given to be able to sleep a few moments. But deep inside, I knew that to sleep meant to die. And something in me rebelled against that death. Death, which was settling in all around me, silently, gently. It would seize upon a sleeping person, steal into him, and devour him bit by bit. Next to me, someone was trying to awaken his neighbor, his brother, perhaps, or his comrade. In vain. Defeated, he lay down too, next to the corpse, and also fell asleep. Who would wake him up? Reaching out with my arm, I touched him.
Wake up! One mustn't fall asleep here.
He half opened his eyes.
No advice, he said, his voice a whisper. I'm exhausted. Mind your business. Leave me alone.
My father, too, was gently dozing. I couldn't see his eyes. His cap was covering his face.
Wake up,
I whispered in his ear. He awoke with a start. He sat up, bewildered, stunned, like an orphan. He looked all around him, taking it all in, as if he had suddenly decided to make an inventory of his universe, to determine where he was and how and why he was there. Then he smiled. I shall always remember that smile. What world did it come from? Heavy snow continued to fall over the corpses. The door of the shed opened. An old man appeared. His mustache was covered with ice. His lips were blue. It was Rabbi Eliyahu, who had headed a small congregation in Poland. A very kind man, beloved by everyone in the camp, even by the kapos and the Black Altesti. Despite the ordeals and deprivations, his face continued to radiate his innocence. He was the only rabbi whom nobody ever failed to address as Rabbi in Buna. He looked like one of those prophets of old, always in the midst of his people when they needed to be consoled. And strangely, his words never provoked anyone. They did bring peace. As he entered the shed, his eyes, brighter than ever, seemed to be searching for someone.
"Perhaps someone here has seen my son?"
He had lost his son in the commotion. He had searched for him among the dying to no avail. Then he had dug through the snow to find his body. In vain. For 3 years they had stayed close to one another. Side by side, they had endured the suffering, the blows. They had waited for their ration of bread, and they had prayed. 3 years, from camp to camp, from selection to selection. And now, when the end seemed near, fate had separated them. When he came near me, Rabbi Eliyahu whispered,
"It happened on the road. We lost sight of one another during the journey. I fell behind a little, at the rear of the column. I didn't have the strength to run anymore, and my son didn't notice. That's all I know. Where has he disappeared? Where can I find him? Perhaps you've seen him somewhere?"
"No, Rabbi Eliyahu, I haven't seen him."
And so he left, as he had come, a shadow swept away by the wind. He had already gone through the door when I remembered that I had noticed his son running beside me. I had forgotten, and so had not mentioned it to Rabbi Eliyahu. But then I remembered something else. His son had seen him losing ground, sliding back to the rear of the column. He had seen him, and he had continued to run in front, letting the distance between them become greater. A terrible thought crossed my mind. What if he had wanted to be rid of his father? He had felt his father growing weaker, and believing that the end was near, had thought by this separation to free himself of a burden that could diminish his own chance for survival. It was good that I had forgotten all that, and I was glad that Rabbi Eliyahu continued to search for his beloved son. And in spite of myself, a prayer formed inside me, a prayer to this God in whom I no longer believed. O God, Master of the universe, give me the strength never to do what Rabbi Eliyahu's son has done. There was shouting outside in the courtyard. Night had fallen, and the SS were ordering us to form ranks. We started to march once more. The dead remained in the yard, under the snow, without even a marker, like fallen guards. No one recited Kaddish over them. Sons abandoned the remains of their fathers without a tear. On the road it snowed and snowed. It snowed endlessly. We were marching more slowly. Even the guards seemed tired. My wounded foot no longer hurt, probably frozen. I felt I had lost that foot. It had become detached from me, like a wheel fallen off a car. Never mind. I had to accept the fact. I would have to live with only one leg. The important thing was not to dwell on it, especially now. Leave those thoughts for later. Our column had lost all appearance of discipline. Everyone walked as he wished, as he could. No more gunshots. Our guards surely were tired. But death hardly needed their help. The cold was conscientiously doing its work. At every step, somebody fell down and ceased to suffer. From time to time, SS officers on motorcycles drove the length of the column to shake off the growing apathy.
Hold on, we're almost there.
Courage, just a few more hours.
We're arriving at Glavitz.
These words of encouragement, even coming as they did from the mouths of our assassins, were of great help. Nobody wanted to give up now, just before the end, so close to our destination. Our eyes searched the horizon for the barbed wire of Glavitz. Our only wish was to arrive there quickly. By now it was night. It had stopped snowing. We marched a few more hours before we arrived. We saw the camp only when we stood right in front of its gate. The capos quickly settled us into the barrack. There was shoving and jostling, as if this were the ultimate haven, the gateway to life. People trod over numbed bodies, trampled, wounded faces. There were no cries, only a few moans. My father and I were thrown to the ground by this rolling tide. From beneath me came a desperate cry.
You're crushing me. Have mercy.
The voice was familiar.
You're crushing me. Mercy. Have mercy.
The same faint voice, the same cry I had heard somewhere before. This voice had spoken to me one day. When? Years ago? No, it must have been in the camp.
Mercy.
Knowing that I was crushing him, preventing him from breathing, I wanted to get up and disengage myself to allow him to breathe. But I myself was crushed under the weight of other bodies. I had difficulty breathing. I dug my nails into unknown faces. I was biting my way through, searching for air. No one cried out. Suddenly I remembered.
Juliek, the boy from Warsaw, who played the violin in the Buna Orchestra. Juliek, is that you? Eliezer, the 25 whiplashes. Yes, I remember.
He fell silent. A long moment went by.
Juliet, can you hear me, Juliet? Yes,
he said feebly.
What do you want?
He was not dead.
Are you all right, Juliet?
I asked, less to know his answer than to hear him speak, to know he was alive.
All right, Eliezer, all right. Not too much air. Tired. My feet are swollen. It's good to rest. But my violin...
I thought he'd lost his mind. His violin? Here?
What about your violin?
He was gasping.
I'm afraid. They'll break my violin. I brought it with me.
I could not answer him. Someone had lain down on top of me, smothering me. I couldn't breathe through my mouth or my nose. Sweat was running down my forehead and my back. This was it. The end of the road. A silent death,
suffocation. No way to scream, to call for help.
I tried to rid myself of my invisible assassin. My whole desire to live became concentrated in my nails. I scratched. I fought for a breath of air. I tore at decaying flesh that did not respond. I could not free myself of that mass weighing down my chest. Who knows? Was I struggling with a dead man? I shall never know. All I can say is that I prevailed. I succeeded in digging a hole in that wall of dead and dying people. A small hole through which I could drink a little air.
"Father, are you there?"
I asked as soon as I was able to utter a word. I knew that he could not be far from me.
"Yes,"
a voice replied from far away, as if from another world.
"I am trying to sleep."
He was trying to sleep. Could one fall asleep here? Wasn't it dangerous to lower one's guard, even for a moment, when death could strike at any time? Those were my thoughts when I heard the sound of a violin. A violin in a dark barrack where the dead were piled on top of the living? Who was this madman who played the violin here at the edge of his own grave? Or was it a hallucination? It had to be Juliak. He was playing a fragment of a Beethoven concerto. Never before had I heard such a beautiful sound in such silence. How had he succeeded in disengaging himself, to slip out from under my body without my feeling it? The darkness enveloped us. All I could hear was the violin, and it was as if Juliak's soul had become his bow. He was playing his life. His whole being was gliding over the strings. His unfulfilled hopes, his charred past, his extinguished future. He played that which he would never play again. I shall never forget Juliak. How could I forget this concert given before an audience of the dead and dying? Even today, when I hear that particular piece by Beethoven, my eyes close, and out of the darkness emerges the pale and melancholy face of my Polish comrade, bidding farewell to an audience of dying men. I don't know how long he played. I was overcome by sleep. When I awoke at daybreak, I saw Juliak facing me, hunched over, dead. Next to him lay his violin, trampled, an eerily poignant little corpse. We stayed in Gliwice for 3 days, days without food or water. We were forbidden to leave the barrack. The door was guarded by the SS. I was hungry and thirsty. I must have been very dirty and disheveled, to judge by what the others looked like. The bread we had brought from Buna had been devoured long since, and who knew when we would be given another ration? The front followed us. We would again hear the cannons very close by, but we no longer had the strength or the courage to think that the Germans would run out of time, that the Russians would reach us before we could be evacuated. We learned that we would be moved to the center of Germany. On the third day, at dawn, we were driven out of the barrack. We threw blankets over our shoulders, like prayer shawls. We were directed to a gate that divided the camp in two. A group of SS officers stood waiting. A word flew through our ranks. Selection. The SS officers were doing the selection. The weak to the left. Those who walked well, to the right. My father was sent to the left. I ran after him. An SS officer shouted at my back, "Come back!" I inched my way through the crowd. Several SS men rushed to find me, creating such confusion that a number of people were able to switch over to the right, among them my father and I. Still, there were gunshots, and some dead. We were led out of the camp. After a half-hour march, we arrived in the very middle of a field crossed by railroad tracks. This was where we were to wait for the train's arrival. Snow was falling heavily. We were forbidden to sit down or to move. A thick layer of snow was accumulating on our blankets. We were given bread, the usual ration. We threw ourselves on it. Someone had the idea of quenching his thirst by eating snow. Soon we were all imitating him. As we were not permitted to bend down, we took out our spoons and ate the snow off our neighbors' backs. A mouthful of bread and a spoonful of snow. The SS men who were watching were greatly amused by the spectacle. The hours went by. Our eyes were tired from staring at the horizon, waiting for the liberating train to appear. It arrived only very late that evening, an infinitely long train, composed of roofless cattle cars. The SS shoved us inside, 100 per car. We were so skinny. When everybody was on board, the convoy left.